This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Every year about this time, the Lake Area United Way gets ready for start of a new community campaign. And for 2019 going into 2020, it's involving not only the community, but it's involving volunteerism. And to tell us more about it, we have the Community Engagement Manager of the Lake Area United Way with us, Megan Sykes. Thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we understand that it's that time, and Unity in Our Community Week is coming up very, very soon. Give us some information as to some of the background on how you and your colleagues at Lake Area United Way came up with this idea, and maybe a little preview of what the week is going to be all about.
Yeah, definitely. So for the longest time, United Ways all across the country have done Day of Caring, so really a one-day push to get volunteers out and into the community and giving back. And we were one of the United Ways that did that for a very long time. And kind of over the years, we sort of realized for a lot of our volunteers, it's kind of hard to all be out on one day. So if you're at a company or something, you know, you can't really have all your employees leave the office on one day to go volunteer. And on the flip side of that, with the nonprofits, it was a little bit hard for them to necessarily have all their projects on one day as well. You know, there may be another day of the week that just works better for them. So we sort of moved it into a full week-long kind of week of caring, which we then called Unity in Our Community Week, kind of, you know, emphasizing the fact that we all need to come together and give back to make our community a better place for all. So it's just a week-long push to get people out volunteering. There's a ton of different projects that people can get involved with. They take place Monday through Friday, all throughout the week. We do have a couple Saturday projects as well, but, you know, morning projects, night projects, middle of the day project. So it's really great for volunteers to find something that fits their schedule. Great for kids, great for teens, great for seniors. Just a great way to get out and give back.
I understand there's a nice little list of some of the activities that are planned all through the week for Unity in Our Community Week. Bring us up to date on some of these projects that are volunteer projects, of course, in various agencies and with United Way that will get people involved in helping giving back to the community.
Yeah, so all of the projects are listed on our volunteer website, which is volunteerlakecounty.org. To get specifically to the Unity in Our Community projects, it's volunteerlakecounty.org/unity. Really exciting this year, we've got some virtual opportunities. So if you're not able to get out of the office and volunteer, but you still want to give back, you can do some virtual donation drives to help with things like hygiene kits or back-to-school supplies. There are some organizations that are looking, like Phil's Friends and Crown Point, they're looking for help packing care packages for people who are dealing with cancer. Tradewind Services is looking for people to come out and do some beautification around their group homes, make the homes a little bit nicer for the residents there. We Care from the Heart in Hammond is doing a block party for the homeless, so providing homeless individuals with access to different resources as well as food and clothing, and so they need volunteers to help with that. The Alzheimer's Association is looking for volunteers to help promote their upcoming walk and get the information out about that. So there's really a wide variety, whether you're, you know, wanting to do something that's kind of outside and more hands-on. You know, there's kind of more of those building projects. Then there are, like I said, there's the virtual projects for those who can't necessarily get out and volunteer. Some that are, you know, more inside projects like the care kit. So really kind of a wide variety.
Do you think that many of these opportunities that come up for volunteerism during Unity in Our Community Week are also opportunities for many of the nonprofits to be able to show themselves off that maybe aren't always right there on top? They're under the radar a little bit. Phil's Friends, for example, comes to mind. We've had a chance to talk with Phil some time back about his organization and about the fact that they do a lot of volunteer work, and they have volunteers come in and do a lot of the packing of the care packages that go out. But sometimes you think that maybe only the people involved, particularly with a particular agency or a particular nonprofit, know what's going on. And this is a way to get a really widespread public view of it.
Exactly, definitely. That's one of the main selling points for all of the nonprofits to partner with us on this is it opens the door to new people who've never heard of your organization. It gets them in. You can talk to them about what you do, make them supporters. So, yeah, it's a great opportunity not only for the nonprofits but for volunteers in general to learn about new organizations and learn about new causes and new and different ways that they can get involved.
I know that the information telling us about Unity in Our Community Week coming up is also an opportunity to give at least a hint the fact that that particular week, which is August 5th through the 9th, is going to be the official start for this year's new community campaign. We know things have changed quite a bit as far as the United Way is concerned, Lake Area United Way in particular. They've gone from the traditional doling of assistance to organizations all around the region to kind of zeroing in on specific topics and problems and the like. And are any clues to what the upcoming community campaign is going to be all about?
Well, so our upcoming community campaign is very much focused on struggling working families. So those families that, you know, they make too much money to qualify for any kind of government assistance, but they're still not quite making enough to make ends meet. So really kind of trying to raise funds to help with programming specific to those families, most specifically around jobs, job training, access to the livable wage jobs, and child care. So access to quality, affordable child care. And how do we, you know, how do we bring the community together to figure out solutions to these issues so that we can make it so that these families aren't just struggling to survive, but they're actually thriving.
Is it probably a rather scary number of people that are out there in Northwest Indiana and in Lake County in particular that kind of fit into that pattern?
Yeah, it's actually one in four families in Lake County is, wow, in that situation.
When you have a big project like this one with Unity in Our Community Week coming up here, and you mentioned about how the individual nonprofits and even United Way is going to be involved in this, it all gets kicked off, I know, with a big way to send everybody off on the volunteer trail starting in on Monday, August 5th. Tell us a little bit about the big rally that's going to be held at Wicker Park.
Yeah, so we'll do a kickoff rally from 4 to 7 at Wicker Park. Just kind of, a chance for us to get everyone together, get everyone pumped up and motivated, not only for the volunteer week, but for the campaign in general. We're going to do a beach volleyball tournament. So we use a giant beach ball, not the regular typical volleyball. But it's just a fun kind of silly way for people to get together. And, you know, you can challenge other, if you work for, you know, a company and you want to challenge another company to fight or to go against in the tournament, you can do that. But just kind of a fun way to get people thinking about, you know, how can we help our community?
When you have an opportunity like this to come up with the projects that in turn will get all of the volunteers that are out there in Northwest Indiana and Lake County in particular involved, how much work do you get to do with the individual nonprofits as you get things set up for the Unity in Our Community Week that's coming up?
A lot, which is really fun because it's, again, even for me, you know, I work with a lot of the nonprofits just in my general day-to-day life, but there's still so many out there that I don't know of. And so when I get to meet them and find out what they do, that's really cool for me on a personal level, but also then to be able to help connect, volunteers to them throughout the year. So not just during Unity and our Community Week, but, you know, knowing what they do and being able to send people to them all throughout the year is really cool.
Do you get to go around to the individual nonprofits, talk with the staffers and the CEOs and actually get to see what they're doing on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, we try to. We also this year we had some training sessions, so we had people kind of come in groups and kind of learn about what Unity in Our Community was, learn about the volunteerlakecounty.org website and how, again, they can post year-round their projects. But yeah, we do. We try to get out as much as we can and meet with people and learn about what they're doing.
If, once again, anybody would like to find out more about the volunteer opportunities that are going to be coming up here during the Unity in Our Community Week, how can they find out more now?
They can find out, again, they can go to volunteerlakecounty.org/unity, or they can reach out to me directly. My phone number is 219-923-2302, extension 311.
Well, Megan, thank you very much for telling us what Unity in Our Community Week is going to be all about, starting on August 5th with the big rally that's going to happen at Wicker Park in Highland, Indiana, and continuing through August 9th. We appreciate to find out more and looking forward to the start of the new community campaign coming up during that week as well. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Megan Sykes is the Community Engagement Manager for Lake Area United Way. Well, it's once again the time that the Indiana Arts Commission is handing out the fiscal year 2020 career development grants, and there are a number of people here in Northwest Indiana who will be receiving those. Let's check in with Rex Van Zandt. He's in charge of marketing and communications for the Indiana Arts Commission based in Indianapolis. And Rex, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Well, thanks for having me, Chris. I appreciate it.
As a reminder to people, what are the career development grants all about? How are these things determined by the IAC? And tell us about the folks that are getting them up here in the region this year.
Well, the individual advancement program actually began several years ago as the individual artist program. Title changed just a little bit, but the real purpose of the program has not changed, and that's to provide grants to individual artists that will assist them in advancing their careers. Mm-hmm. So an individual artist may need to buy a piece of equipment, for example. Say a potter needs maybe a larger kiln or something like that. Or, you know, a writer may want to go to a writer's retreat. Or, you know, there's any number of things that artists can apply for. The key thing is, will it advance their career? And will it allow them to have the ability to be successful in their career and remain in the state of Indiana and also contribute back to their community in various ways, programs, demonstrations, things like that. So that's the purpose of the program. And every year we open up grant applications for the individual advancement program. We usually divide this, for example, in this particular fiscal year, it's going to be based on performance arts disciplines, and then next year it will be more the visual arts. So that's kind of how we break the categories down. Artists will submit their proposal, their program proposal, and then typically in the early spring, usually in April, probably mid to late April, early May, we impanel grant panelists from around the state, sometimes from outside the state, but they're experts in those particular disciplines. So they have some degree of expertise looking at the grants. We try to determine, you know, can the artist achieve this? You know, will it significantly advance their career? And then they're scored. And then the panels make recommendations back to the Arts Commission. Then the commission considers these at its June quarterly meeting, and then typically the grants are usually about $2,000 max. Sometimes artists ask for less. They sometimes only ask for what they actually need. But then we award the grants after the June commission meeting.
Now, there are a number of people, as we mentioned. I think that altogether there are, I believe, if my count's right, nine from Northwest Indiana in particular, from Lake Porter and the Port counties, who are in Region 1 of the IAC and are going to receive their grants. Let's take a look at the list and look at some of these. Some of these have more, I guess, unusual requests than others, but some are kind of run-of-the-mill, or I guess what might be seem to be run-of-the-mill. First, tell us a little about Sam Barnett. He's from Gary here in Lake County. He has asked for some funds to be able to work on a literature project. Tell us about that.
What Sam's looking to do is explore poetic history of Indiana. He's going to do a series of writing workshops and going to be holding these at libraries in Carroll County. And the Carroll County Poetry Project workshops are going to generate placed focus poems to be published in a chapbook and read at a performance to honor Hoosier poet James Whitcomb Riley.
One of the other persons is asking for a career advancement grant from the IAC is Erica Goodman. She's from Valparaiso, and she's asked for something for a music project. Will you tell us what Erica's interested in?
Yeah, she's going to be producing a CD. It's a recording project that is going to document some new works for horn musicians and by living American composers. The compositions are selected for a connection to geographical landscapes, including the Devil's Tower National Monument and Crook County, Wyoming, and three New England landscapes. They're going to be captured in paintings of American artist Frederick Edwin Church.
Jessica Renslow, who is from the Miller neighborhood in Gary, is another person who's receiving an IAC advancement grant for her work, personal work in literature. Tell us a little bit of what Jessica is interested in doing with the funds that she'd receive.
As I mentioned earlier, sometimes the artist will be maybe doing something maybe attending a workshop, and in this particular case, Jessica is going to be doing a writing workshop, lead a final draft of a middle grade novel that she's been working on that's featuring two girls on an accidental adventure that neither will forget, according to her description. And the workshop is going to be able to give her an opportunity to present public readings and honoring the complex relationships between Indiana's epic environment, industry, and young people.
Finally here, let's take a look on the list here. Another person that is taking up the musical bend, so to speak, is somebody that you would not necessarily associate with music. In fact, he's an attorney here in Northwest Indiana, Adam Cedia. He's picking up some funds to work on a music project. Tell us about that.
You're just sharing some news with me because I did not realize that he's an attorney and not necessarily primarily an artist.
He's a very accomplished poet in his own right, besides being a barrister. So he knows the written word real well. I think maybe something to be noted about his musical skills.
Well, he's going to be completing a live recording of his cycle of piano sonatas and provide a lecture series on the music appreciation and the sonata form.
Well, these sound all interesting. And then I guess, too, if anybody's interested in looking at the entire list of the career development grant recipients, including those from Northwest Indiana, they can do so on the Indiana Arts Commission website, right?
Absolutely.
That's Rex Van Zandt. He is with the Indiana Arts Commission. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
My mother bought a house from the Costas family on Fifth Avenue, where I still live, called the Horace Mann neighborhood then as it is now. I was actually at the very historic Roosevelt High School, but I left, graduated from Roosevelt and went to Indiana State, which was in the same town where my grandmother was still living, Terre Haute. She was a Du Bois Talented 10th when she graduated from Fisk. And she was there with her other graduates. They resolved themselves, and they said that they were to go out back into their communities and use their education to help people. So it's hard for me to just talk about neighborhood without neighborhood, community, and country, the three of them together. I remember she was so active in the community. She actually had us doing a lot of community work. So we did a newsletter. She was state secretary for the NAACP. And we would have to fold and staple and address and stamp about 500 newsletters, So people wonder why we're able to do so many things today. I said, well, I'm able to do them because that's what I had to do. I was always in the community. I was always doing things in the community. So even at Indiana State, we had to press for a African-American sorority, which the dean at that time did not want. But there were four of us that started the chapter there that eventually became a chapter. I also started a tutoring program for little children because I had gone to an NAACP meeting and the community was a little upset and they wanted to know why the black students at Indiana State were not doing more in the community. And so I went out, started a tutoring program, and the Methodist Church came and helped me and supported me. And that, I understand that program stayed for a while, might even still be going on. We were taught that this was our country and that we were to be proud of our country, but we had to make our country do the right thing. My mother was a student. She was getting her master's at Purdue Lafayette, and she invited a friend of hers from Washington by the name of Dr. Nancy Arnaz to come and be her guest speaker. And Dr. Arnaz talked about this place that sounded like heaven, and it was called the Center for Inner City Studies. And I wanted to go. I practically followed her back. As soon as I got back to Gary, I found a way to get over there to find out what was going on. I ended up getting my master's through that program. I worked through what was called the follow-through program. We took the children that left Head Start, and we worked with them. We had four schools in Chicago. We opened schools in Topeka, Kansas, and also Compton, California. So we had schools in three states, three cities. And we had a culturally based curriculum, which I still use today with our programs here with the Gary Historical and Cultural Society. So again, neighborhood and community, country, those were all, to me, connected. And community struggles, fighting the system, is part of my background. So that's to answer your question. I don't know any other way to operate. I can't just sit around and just look at things and say, oh, well, that's the way it is. Maybe when I can't walk anymore, I might have to end up doing that. But I don't know if I'll do that then.
And you can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. Indiana American Water Company has been granted some of what it had sought from state utility regulators, a two-phase rate increase, the first phase of which took effect officially yesterday. And I had a chance to talk with Anthony Swinger with the Indiana Office of Utility Consumer Counselor about it.
Well, last week, the Regulatory Commission issued the final order in the Indiana American Water rate case. This is a case that's been going on for nearly a year, and it's a case in which Indiana American had originally asked for a rate increase of about $38.8 million per year. We and other parties negotiated a settlement agreement in the case that brings the final number down to about $17.5 million. So the utility will be getting roughly half of the increase that it requested, and that was approved last week by the commission. It's going to be a phased-in increase. Part of the increase takes effect now. The rest of it takes effect at the end of April.
Mm-hmm.
So there will be a phase-in of the rate changes.
I guess it's not as much as what the utility had originally asked for. Do they want to have all that that they had originally asked for to cover any infrastructure costs they figured they were going to incur?
Infrastructure is the big driver here, and aging infrastructure is a major, major issue, not only for water utilities, but all utilities throughout the country. The need for utilities to invest and replace aging infrastructure, put in new infrastructure where needed, it's a very real need. It's not limited to American Water. It's not limited to Northwest Indiana. It is a nationwide issue.
Mm-hmm.
So the need for revenues to pay for that is there. At the same time, we recognize that no one likes a rate increase. And if there is going to be an increase, it has to be done in the manner that is most fair to the ratepayer. With that in mind, we thoroughly analyzed Indiana American's request over a period of several months. We offered a number of recommendations. Down the road, we were able to enter into settlement negotiations and produce the agreement that was approved last week.
Mm-hmm.
But looking at the individual costs in the utility's proposal, looking at the projects, are these really needed? What is the appropriate price for those? Those are all things that we look at very, very carefully in any rate case. This case was no exception to that.
I imagine you probably were watching very closely what the average user of water in the system would have to pay. And if I look at it right, they keep throwing out this number of 4,000 gallons a month. I probably don't know anybody that uses only 4,000 gallons a month, but that's a month. But that's, I guess, a good indicator on the average customer. And they were supposed to, I guess, pay maybe about 30 cents more a month at first here for this first increase that kicked in here on Monday. And then what about $2.50 a month after that, I guess, once the full increase takes effect.
Yeah, and all the data are in the tariff that would have been filed by the utility. Tariffs are posted online, and consumers can look directly at those numbers if they want to, and if they want to get a better sense as to how it would affect them at the specific level that they use. The primary thing that we looked at in the case was the overall revenue, the overall amount that the utility needs versus what it asked for, and the agreement provides, in our view, the right balance between investments needed for safe, dependable water and fair rates at the same time.
I know the industrial customers had something to say about this, too. In fact, we had, two from Northwest and three, really, from Northwest Indiana. We had ArcelorMittal USA, at least the Northwest Indiana component, as well as the cities of Crown Point and Schererville. They intervened in the matter as well, too. What were their concerns that they had mentioned here at the outset of the case?
I'm not familiar with all of the concerns that the other parties brought to the commission's attention. I can only speak for the consumer counselor's office. But what I can tell you is that all of the parties, including the industrial customers, the municipal governments, the Citizens Action Coalition, all entered into the settlement agreement. So this was a global agreement that was reached among all the parties in the case that was approved by the commission.
So we just now have the one phase that's already gone into effect. The other one is to go in later. We assume that I'm sure that at some point in time, Indiana American Water Company will probably have to come back to the URC and with hat in hand, so to speak, ask for more money.
It's inevitable that any utility will need to seek a rate increase at some point. You know, is that in a couple of years? Is that in 10 years? I don't have a crystal ball.
Yeah.
But certainly providing the revenues that are necessary at the present time, you know, and looking a little bit ahead as far as the infrastructure needs, all those things are taken into account in the rate case.
They seem to be, of course, concerned not only about whatever it costs them to be able to supply the water that they have to supply everybody else, but you say the aging infrastructure has gotten to be a really big point these days, I guess.
It is a major issue. I know that down here in Indianapolis, you have some sewer mains that date all the way back to the 1880s. And there are other utilities around the state and the country where the pipes have been in the ground for decades. So it is a concern, and it is something that has to be addressed.
I know that recently crews in Chicago had to replace a main that dated back to before the Chicago fire. And it's amazing that probably any of them have survived that long, but
wow. They've
been around that long. So it's not surprising that we should have old water mains and old sewers to have to deal with there, too. We just have to wait and see what's going to happen in the future, apparently, Anthony.
Very, very common issue, very much a nationwide issue.
Anthony Swinger is a spokesperson for the Indiana Office of Utility Consumer Counselor. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We have now gone to the point in the General Assembly work from this past session that the measures that made it past the House and the Senate and maybe had to have things worked out in conference committee in some cases have finally gone to the governor and become law. Let's check in with Ed Feigenbaum. He is with the Hanna News Service, and he is the editor of the Gaming Inside Indiana and the Legislative Inside Indiana newsletters. As always, Ed, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Hey, happy fiscal new year, Chris.
That's right. That's right. One of the big measures, and certainly we have been keeping a very close eye on up here in Northwest Indiana, as you have too, because of the gaming aspect, is the House Enrollment Act 1015, which, as I recall, that's the gaming omnibus bill is what I think it's gotten called by some of the State House reporters over time. Tell us about the changes that that now new law is making and how some of these projects that have been thought about are coming along.
Sure, Chris. And we've talked about this before, and I think a lot of other people refer to this not as the omnibus gaming bill, but as the kitchen sink bill, because it basically deals with every aspect of gaming in the state of Indiana. And we saw kind of a mirror image bill, you know, obviously considerably different, but dealing with the same kinds of topics in a different way, just get signed by the governor of Illinois a couple of days ago. But the Indiana bill, you know, for people in Northwest Indiana, first and foremost, would allow the move of one of the two Gary casino licenses to an inland location off the footprint, would probably be somewhere along I-80, 94, and we're going to hear very soon, I think, about where specifically that might be. And then the other license would essentially be surrendered to the state with the opportunity for them, the owners, Spectacle Entertainment LLC, to compete for a new license in Vigo County. And there will be a referendum on the November ballot in Vigo County, the whole county, not just Terre Haute, but the whole county. Even the jurisdictions don't have city or town elections, and that will be a referendum to see if the voters will approve that, just like the advisory Gary referendum in 1989 and then the subsequent 1993 referenda in the cities that now have the riverboats in Lake County, and then also the county referenda, the ones that did not pass in 93 and later in Porter County, and the one that did pass in LaPorte County. So you're going to see a referendum down there, and the second Gary license may effectively, although not necessarily directly, move to Vigo County. That's going to be an open competition, so it's not necessarily going to be Spectacle that would end up with that property, but they're probably the front runner and the most interested in it. We're also going to see some other minor changes in the riverboat casino world, including some tax law changes that will benefit the casinos and also be kind of consumer-friendly, enable the casinos to perhaps offer some better odds and certainly more promotions, more marketing to the patrons. So there'll probably be some more coupons and different kinds of promotional opportunities. And then the two racinos in Anderson and Shelbyville will be able to turn into actual casinos. They will have live table games literally at midnight on January 1st. So at the same time that everybody from Lake County is going to be flocking into Illinois for the legal use of recreational marijuana on January 1st, I think people around Indianapolis are going to be moving toward Shelbyville and Anderson to wager on live table games at what are now the two racinos. We'll also be able to bet on different kinds of sporting activities, essentially everything except real amateur, you know, high school and below athletics and esports. But you'll be able to wager on college athletics, major college athletics events, things like golf tournaments, auto racing, professional football, baseball, hockey, basketball. And unlike the Illinois law that was just signed, you will be able to wager in Indiana on Indiana collegiate teams. So, for example, if you're in Chicago and you are a Chicago resident or an Illinois resident, you're not going to be able to place a bet in Illinois at one of the sports wagering parlors on the University of Illinois or Northwestern or on DePaul basketball or Loyola basketball. But if you are wagering in Indiana, you would be able to bet on those types of collegiate events, even though they're going on in Illinois. Mm-hmm. And Indiana is also offering the mobile wagering option, and that will be, as they say, geo-fenced. So that the minute you kind of set foot onto the Chicago Skyway, you're not going to be able to bet on things in Indiana. You're going to be essentially locked out on your mobile device. So those are the basic changes. There are a few other little things that are involved as well. There's some charitable gaming changes that are of some interest to people in that industry, and that's a huge industry. I mean, we still see, you know, somewhere around $450 million a year wagered at charitable gaming events, things like bingos and raffles and events along those lines. So a lot of different things in that kitchen sink or omnibus bill, most of which took effect this week, but some of which will not become effective, such as the live table games and the sports wagering, until, you know, a few months down the line.
Do you think in particular those cases where the racinos have to be ready to be able to take on the live table games that they probably had to wait until the measure became officially law, and then they have to, of course, they probably got some planning ahead of time, but then they have to start getting to work and actually get those tables and find the space for all those, so that come midnight, December 31st or 12:01 a.m. January 1st, they're ready to put them on?
Yeah, they'll be able to do that. It's a lot easier to move in some tables than it is to move around and get certified, you know, slot machines. You know, obviously, they're going to be housing them in newish facilities. Shelbyville has plans for a bigger build-out for the table games, and they're going to be getting started on that almost immediately. Anderson, I think they're a little bit further behind in the planning on that because they've got a differently structured facility, but they're also looking ahead as well to sports wagering and to be putting in a sports book there, and that's going to figure into the plans, and it's going to make things a little bit more complicated. And most of the casinos are going to come up with some type of segregated sports book facility. Some of that will be new construction. Some of it will be incorporated into current facilities. Some of them, like the Horseshoe Casino, Southern Indiana in Harrison County, they're in the midst of building a land-based casino right now that will open probably somewhere around October or so. And, you know, they had been doing this with the thought that, you know, yes, one of these rooms can be converted into a sports book, and, you know, they've gone and changed their design plans accordingly, and they're incorporating that into the land-based facility process right now.
In the past week since we first talked about this, about the Illinois measure that was passed by the General Assembly over in Springfield, are we finding more information that's come out now that has either allayed some fears or made people over here in Northwest Indiana a bit more fearful of what the plans are in Illinois for new casinos?
I think we're hearing more discussion. I don't know that we're getting any more information or more intelligence. I think some of this is starting to soak in, and people are realizing that just because we've got casinos authorized for Rockford and Waukegan and Danville, for example, doesn't mean that you're going to have a top of the line operator like a Caesars Entertainment Corporation come in and put in a $300 million facility like they might have 20 years ago when the competition was a little bit different, and we had either a monopoly type situation, or certainly at least an oligopoly type situation, because that doesn't exist anymore. You just have too much gambling, and in Illinois, in particular, you've got the video gaming terminals, which are also being expanded, that have become ubiquitous around the state, particularly in the smaller cities and towns, and those are taking patrons away from casinos and giving the casino operators, less of a reason to open a major facility. So will there be a casino in Waukegan and Rockford and Danville? Well, certainly I think you'll see one in Rockford and Waukegan, but it's not going to be, a $300 million facility. It may not even be, $125 million. It may be a $50 to $75 million, facility, one of those things that perhaps, 10 years ago were derisively referred to as slot barns, because they were just kind of put up slapdash and with the ability to kind of tear them down if it turned out the competition was going to put them under.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to see the kinds of destination facilities like you've got in Des Plaines, like you've got in Elgin. There's really no incentive for the operators to build those kinds of properties in some of these communities. Now, Danville may be the most interesting because Danville is an hour away from Terre Haute,
Yeah. And
they would be competing against a Vigo County casino, and it looks like Vigo County would be able to get their property up and running quicker than Danville. And, it just may be that no major operator or no operator of any consequence comes in and says, yeah, we think that this is a good proposition. It's very difficult to see, given the lay of the land, that anybody other than a very, very small operator would come in and propose anything but a very small, $50 million at tops property for Danville. And I don't even think that you're going to end up seeing that.
One thing I did want to ask about, and it's come up here recently, there's been a lot of talk on the south side of Chicago, and of course, it's getting dangerously close to the Indiana casinos that are still in operation, of course, as to what might happen in establishing a casino in the south side of Chicago. And there has been talk, and you've probably seen it as well, too, that some folks in the neighborhood want to see an opportunity to be able to turn that land that's been sitting fallow, used to be a steel mill, there on the south side, into something usable. They'd had other projects that have failed, and they thought that maybe this time, maybe a casino might be the ticket, so to speak. Does that seem to be a possibility, since we know that there have been talk about creating something on the south side of Chicago?
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility. The old Chicago U.S. Steel Works is certainly, an option.
Yeah.
But a lot of this is really going to be determined independently. The gaming board in Illinois has about another week, I think it is, to select an independent consultant. And I think, there's a pretty narrow field of people who do this kind of work. And they are going to make recommendations as to where this ought to be placed based upon, the other kinds of competition, based upon, the expected type of facility, based upon the market, based upon potential visitation patterns, everything. And they're going to make that recommendation. And I think that recommendation is going to weigh, very highly in the minds of the gaming board members and Mayor Lightfoot and Governor Pritzker. And you have to remember that Governor Pritzker, has a little bit of family background in the casino business himself. And, his his family's Hyatt Gaming Management Corporation, you know, used to run the Elgin Casino and used to run the Grand Victoria Casino in Rising Sun, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
So they know a little bit about this, and you know, even if he wasn't necessarily directly involved, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, you know, he's picked up some of this by osmosis, and he also knows the right people to talk to. And one of the key executives with Hyatt Gaming Management was a guy who ended up leaving Hyatt Gaming and moving over to run the Majestic Star Casinos for about a decade. So, you know, he knows people who understand the local market, and, you know, he's able to tap into that network as well. And I think that rather than give in to emotion and say, oh, yeah, well, we've got this site that we've just had a tough time, you know, filling, that the housing development kind of fell through for that Chicago Works site, or, you know, we want to do something at McCormick Place to, you know, boost tourism, or, gosh, we've got all this land at Harborside by the landfill and the Lower Calumet, Little Calumet River, and the port down there that's just kind of sitting dormant. Mm-hmm. Let's do something there. I think it's going to be driven by the market, and I think the consultants are going to be doing a good job of kind of stripping emotion from this and giving the Illinois Gaming Board and the officials involved in this, you know, some real options that are based upon reality as opposed to, you know, what certain aldermen might want or what the mayor might prefer.
Well, Ed, thank you very much for spending time to going over some of the finer points and then whatever the situation may be, whether it's Indiana or Illinois, and the gaming picture in particular with the enactment into law of House and Rolled Act 1015. Ed Feigenbaum is the editor of the Gaming Inside Indiana and the Legislative Inside Indiana newsletters for the Hanna News Service. And as always, thank you for spending time with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Well, certainly, Chris. Thank you for having me. And let me put a plug in for a Monday appearance. I'm going to be speaking to the Gary Chamber of Commerce at the Majestic Star Casino Complex Monday afternoon for their monthly luncheon. And we just may have a little bit more insight we can provide there, and we'll be taking questions. So if any of the listeners want to show up, more than welcome.
That's great. Another reason, I suppose, to visit the boat in that way, too. Now, stay away from the gaming floors, at least. Come and have lunch and listen to Ed Feigenbaum talk. Thanks, Ed, for being with us today.
Thank you, Chris. Have a good holiday.
Thank you. You too. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Solving problems, coming up with resolutions at the city level is one reason that mayors from across the country get together for the U.S. Conference of Mayors. This year was the 87th annual conference, and it was held out in Honolulu. Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson from the city of Gary was there. She talked last Friday with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson about what was happening this past weekend.
For the event.
So every summer, the U.S. Conference of Mayors comes together. We consider resolutions. We also look at best practices. As an example, yesterday there was a climate summit that was led and convened by Mayor Eric Garcetti from L.A. as well as Mayor Kirk Caldwell from Honolulu, where we addressed our commitment to the original Paris Accord that was addressing climate change and the issues of concern to all Americans relative to our stewardship around the environment, but also to talk about how do we reduce our carbon footprint as cities, how do we encourage our residents around environmental stewardship, what are some low-hanging fruit and what are some major changes that we can ascribe to and commit to so that as communities around the country, we can see changes. We've all had extreme weather events. We've all seen flooding. We've all seen tornadoes. We've all seen a variety of things such as extreme weather, both in the summer with the rain and in the winter with polar vortexes. So that was just one aspect of this meeting, but we will also deal with issues around public safety, around economic development, around issues relative to the opioid epidemic and vaping. And it's an opportunity to learn from our colleagues around the country. It's also an opportunity to contribute to other communities in those areas where I think we've seen successes. So it's an overall exchange that provides a benefit to communities all over, and, you know, it's an honor to be a part of it, something that I have been actively involved in for the last 8 years.
I know you just touched on it, but what do you think, how has the United States Conference of Mayors made things better in cities overall? Has it solved any major problems or improved on any major challenges?
Well, I think that it has certainly helped us in our relationships with the federal government. As an example, with the Environmental Protection Agency, many of us have consent decrees. Many of us know that it would be very costly to fully implement the measures that would be required in those consent decrees. Through our collective work, through exchange of information, through the U.S. Conference of Mayors, we've been able to mitigate those costs to our communities. So that's a major way. We also have all been challenged by many aspects of public safety. Some have seen police action shootings, and as a result of working with experts like Chuck Ramsey, who was the longstanding commissioner in Philadelphia, also the police chief in Washington, D.C., he has a tremendous expertise and has provided that as a consultant to the U.S. Conference of Mayors, but we're able to talk with him about issues of concern. In fact, most recently, I talked with him about the importance of being prepared for large-scale shootings and for being ready for those and how we can best train our police officers to respond to those crises that occur in some communities. And you know, we don't know that it will ever occur in our community. In fact, we hope that it doesn't. But if it does, we know we want our officers and our police forces to be trained. And the thing about it is that we don't necessarily have to bring everybody here, but by being able to become aware of the training, make the connections and the relationships, we're able to make sure that our officers are able to take advantage of it. I met Michael Bloomberg, as an example, at the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and we know as a result of learning about his public art challenge, we were able to reactivate a somewhat abandoned building, an underperforming building, and lead to Art House, which has been a tremendous boost in that community, in our community.
What do you think is the biggest challenge and the biggest issue for United States mayors to confront and face?
Well, I think it depends on the city. I know that a number of us from Indianapolis to Louisville to other cities, Chicago, are confronted with public safety issues. But you also find those cities that are really concerned about economic mobility. You have portions of the city that are thriving, but you have other areas and other residents who are not. So how do we create an equitable opportunity for all of our residents? Housing is universal. And one of the things that I'll talk about today is housing. When I address the plenary session, is I'll talk about the efforts that we've done around a housing task force through NLC and the partnership that we anticipate from the U.S. Conference of Mayors with that effort. So I think that you find common themes in cities, no matter how large they are, how smart they are, small they are, and certainly the issues around housing is probably the number one concern that mayors have, whether it is homelessness or affordability or gentrification. All of those issues are being faced around this country.
Is there any topic that is pertinent to Gary that you're going to be bringing up at the conference?
Yes. One of the things that I will be talking about is housing, and we've got some developments underway. But yesterday, as we talked about climate change, when we started 8 years ago, there was a lot more beach at Marquette. Now we've probably have half of the beach that we once had. So the erosion of our shoreline is one of the major issues that is being confronted, not just in cities like Gary, but also in Miami. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about how do we address that issue. I'll talk about public safety and my concerns around just getting citizens engaged because, you know, you can hire 300 police officers, but if there are no witnesses who will cooperate with officers so that prosecutors can in turn bring cases to trial and convict people, then you can't create the deterrent that we know exists by not only detecting crime, but holding those responsible accountable for the crimes that they commit. We expect resolutions to come out at this time that will assist us both in dealing with the census, with concerns relative to border security, with concerns relative to fair trade. There are also other issues that I'm sure will come before the conference that will be of relevance to not just Gary citizens, but all citizens all over Northwest Indiana.
Is there any items on the agenda that will work out in Gary's favor that will help the city of Gary?
Yes, I think certainly the work that we will be doing around public safety will be something that I will be able to bring back to Gary and that will benefit Gary citizens.
And what are you going to do after you're no longer mayor?
That has yet to be determined, but there are some really good opportunities on the horizon. You know, one of the things is that I am really proud of the record of accomplishments that we've created over the last 8 years. And, you know, whenever you do something, go somewhere, you want to leave it better than you found it. We have been able to do that. And so I am comfortable. You know, nobody ever runs to lose, but I'm comfortable moving into the next assignment. And I think that certainly serving as mayor was a divine assignment, and I'm just waiting on the next one.
That's Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson speaking with Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson. Mayor Freeman Wilson is coming back from being in charge of the U.S. Conference of Mayors at their 87th annual conference that was held out in Honolulu. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.